From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I'm out here a thousand miles from my home, walking a road other men have gone down. I'm seeing your world of people and things. Here, paupers and peasants and princes and kings.
Bob Dylan, America's premier poet-singer, the man who linked the label singer-songwriter to raspy folk and high art. Dylan's work has millions of fans, followers, acolytes, and wannabes, and among them, a few surprises, like Christopher Ricks, the celebrated British literary critic, the newly appointed Oxford Professor of Poetry, a man the New York Times called a professor's professor, a don's don, who W.H. Auden himself praised as the kind of critic every poet dreams of finding. Now, Christopher Ricks has taken his high scholarship, quick wit, close reading, and stone fandom to the lyrics of America's best-known bard. To Lay Lady Lay and Hattie Carroll, to A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall and Mr. Tambourine Man. And what the great Don finds is near poetic perfection in Bob Dylan's musical verse. Ricks lofts Dylan up among the lions of English poetry, Milton, Blake, Tennyson, T.S. Eliot, and says the case for denying Dylan the title of poet could not be made by any open-minded close attention to the words and his ways with them. Or, as Dylan himself put it in 1978, I consider myself a poet first and a musician second. Tonight on Point, the poetry of Bob Dylan with superfan and scholar Christopher Ricks.
Here's to the hearts and the hands of the men that come with the dust and are gone with the wind.
Joining me now in the studio is Christopher Ricks, newly elected Oxford Professor of Poetry and Professor of Humanities at Boston University. He's the greatly respected literary critic whose writing spans over 40 years and many volumes, from 1963's Milton's Grand Style to Decisions and Revisions in T.S. Eliot in 2003. His latest book is Dylan's Visions of Sin. Welcome, Christopher Ricks.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. So you're a fan, we take it.
Yeah, I hate the word fan, partly because I don't, of course, think I'm any kind of fanatic, really. I think I'm a deeply discriminating admirer. And you?
Well, I'm a simple man. I'm a fan. But after reading these 500 pages, I'm a much more discriminating admirer than I was a couple of days ago. This is an incredible book. You've brought an approach to Bob Dylan that few fans could even dream of.
It's good of you. Of course, I'd like it to be a credible book. I'm glad you find it incredible in the sense of being a good thing, but I would hope people would credit what I say. And one of the difficulties with the reviews in England have been that there are certain people who think that Dylan's words are lax and meaningless and that I'm cleverer than a barrel load of monkeys and therefore I can make up all these things which Mr. Dylan did not make up.
Sort of tart him up and more, make him look like something he's not.
Yes, and the thing that he's not is, of course, a poet whose medium would be words alone. What I try to argue in the book, you'll remember, is that the words are very, very important, of course, and often very, very beautiful and subtle and profound and touching, but this is a mixed medium art. The art of song is the art of music and voice and words. I think you can attend to the words on their own, provided you remember that they are interdependent with these other powers.
Well, you said we don't think Shakespeare less a poet because he put his work on stage in the mouths of actors.
Just so.
And so Bob Dylan, with his guitar, but also behind the music, in your view, poetry.
Yes, and with the particular change of technique that comes with song, there's a very beautiful remark by T.S. Eliot where he says the difference between poetry and prose is a different system of punctuation. that might seem a tiny thing, but they're
different. The way you mix it up, the way you lay it down.
Exactly, the relation of a cadence to a line, to a sense unit, to a musical unit, or to a breath unit. And in song, of course, you always have not only that, but this further thing, melisma, when you take one syllable and you spread it through more than one note. There's no equivalent in poetry or prose to what it is to sing long to rain. rain over us. That's what makes something a song. And even when a song doesn't use melisma, the fact that it can means that it's a different order of punctuation.
You just said that in the UK you've gotten some reviews saying, oh, Christopher Ricks is trying to hoist Dylan up into the pantheon of great poets. Is the American response different? I mean, do you find, as a British scholar, that Americans are more open to your assertion or revelation or confirmation that Bob Dylan is a great poet than British listeners, readers are?
I think there's always a blind spot of some sort. That is, I don't think it could ever be the case that, as it were, the French would be better on French poetry than other people are. You have a gain and a loss from being in or of the culture. Dylan is in some ways very, very Anglo-American. I mean, there's a lot of very good jokes, including jokes about the Englishman. Things have changed, dignity. These are songs which often bring up something to do with Englishness.
Despite his Russian-Jewish Bob Zimmerman Minneapolis roots. Yeah.
World citizen number one, any really great performer of popular music, not just as pop music, wants to be a world citizen. And I think it's very moving to see the delight that people in Japan, the delight that people all over the globe feel him. I think he ought, before he dies, to visit every country if he possibly could. And I hope you'll sign the petition that will get him to go to India, because he's been a bit difficult about going to India, apparently.
Well, amen. Just put it in front of me. I'll sign. I have no problem with Bob Dylan going to India. We want to listen to a lot of music and have you pinging off of it tonight, because you respond so amazingly, and we want to get into your big theme, but let's just get some going here and get Christopher Ricks responding to it. 1964, Bob Dylan, The Times They Are A-Changing.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, or the times they are a-changing.
What you do is close reading. As you listen to this, and we all know it like the back of our hands, what do you hear, Christopher Ricks?
Well, one of the things that I hear is, of course, the setting that I've devised in this book for thinking about this song. I came up with a scheme by which the book is organized, quite loosely, but I hope organized, around the seven deadly sins, the four cardinal virtues, and the three heavenly graces. And I think The Times They Are A-Changing is a great song about prudence. It is full of prudential advice. It says, you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. That's prudence. We tend not to remember how important prudence is. Justice and fortitude have a kind of drama to them, so we remember their virtues. Prudence and temperance sound a bit flat. They're not flat. They're wise and very sane. And this is a song which has a series of prudential advices to you. It starts from a tiny Latin thought, a very ancient thought, times change.
Yes.
It expands that into the times change. It expands that into the times they are changing. It expands that into the times they are a-changing. And it's like an acorn growing into a great oak, I think.
But is it active or passive? Is it the prudent Dylan or the provocateur Dylan who's pushing and saying, the times are changing, and I'm blowing on the flame. I'm making the wind.
That's good. I hadn't thought of that. And, of course, sometimes it is prudent to be provocative. That is, if you think what you're up against is complacency. Dylan's never been complacent at all. And I think the anger that he's sometimes shown in the songs or in interviews will have to do with the feeling that people have become complacent about him or are thinking that he is complacent. They know how his mind works. Do you remember he creates that lovely epithet, protesty?
Yes.
He says, you want to protest something? This is one of my protestiest songs. The songs are songs of social conscience. When he's asked what protest means, remember, he says it means singing songs that I don't want to sing. That is,
you're
I
right.
protest against the idea I've got to do that. So that there's always this lovely, sharp, glinting, sometimes comic, sometimes sardonic, sometimes tragic sense. A lot of tragic humor in Dylan.
Let's get the basics down so that we can follow along with you as you go. You write, Dylan likes setting music to our besetting sins. And because we don't talk about sins in detail anymore, we just do it or live with it. Let's remember the seven: envy, covetousness, greed, sloth, lust, anger, pride. And you set those up in a nice sort of 7v7 against the four virtues: justice, prudence, temperance, fortitude, and the heavenly graces. Now, I have to admit I've lost track of all this stuff, but faith, hope, and charity. I mean, God bless them.
I'm sorry to hear you've lost touch with faith, hope, and charity.
No, more the framing. The heavenly graces, is that a... a religious term? Is it a folk term?
It's a religious term, it's better than theological because it's religious. Mm-hmm. I'm not a religious man, but mm-hmm. one of the things I say in the book and do truly believe is that we have works of art in order to give a sympathetic access to systems of belief that are not our own. The only way in which we ever come to an intelligent respect for things that we don't believe is either through people whom we love, friends and relations, or through works of art. And as an atheist, I surprise myself by being so moved by these religious songs of his, including Christian songs, a phase of his work which has been sneered at, I think, quite unjustly.
Later in life, and we'll come to that. Okay. When you say he likes setting music to our besetting sins, draw that out a bit for us. What do you mean?
Well, we are beset by sins, aren't we, all around? Besetting sins is a cliche. One of the things that the great popular artist does, whether it's Shakespeare or Dylan or T.S. Eliot, in the moments when people can really understand what Eliot is getting at, what you do is take cliches and in some way you either wake them up again when they were asleep or you bring them back to life though they were dead. You galvanize them perhaps like a kind of zombie life, but you do something with cliches. Besetting sin is a cliche. But in fact, we are beset by sin.
Look around.
But as a person who isn't religious, one of the things that's annoyed me about the British reception of the book has been the phrase Christian template. Now, Christians don't have a monopoly of being against envy, lust, covetousness.
It's in every big book.
Exactly. So that although I think there is a difference between pagan virtue and Christian virtue, there are differences between pagans and Christians, as a pagan, I don't like being told that I shouldn't have any interest in the sins.
As we go into a break, talk to us about The Lonesome Death of Hetty Carroll from the same album, 1964. You pay a lot of attention to this. Give us a little close reading of Hetty Carroll.
Well, I'd get into the close reading, if I may, by saying that the challenge that the song faces is not to give in to the anger that it is indicting. It hates William Zanzinger for his anger. The person who killed...
William Zanzinger, tell us the story if you'd be good enough.
Well, William Zanzinger killed for no reason. He just happened to be feeling that way without warning. Mm-hmm. Without warning to him, not just without warning to other people. He's one of these people whom anger suddenly attacks without warning, and he strikes very hard a woman on the head, and she dies. She had been serving drinks at a Baltimore Hotel Society gathering. He's not found guilty of murder. He's charged with murder, but he's not found guilty of murder, and the song, very wisely, doesn't rule on the jury's verdict. But it does find it shocking that the judge who handed out strongly for penalty and repentance simply handed down a 6-month sentence. Now, that does seem a little bit on the lenient side.
So there's the anger, and Bob Dylan says, let's take that anger or hold that anger. How?
Well, let's contain that anger so that in deploring anger, we don't ourselves simply give in to it. It's like the moment when Dylan remembers having sung, rip down all hate, I screamed. Mm. Now, if you scream the words rip down all hate, you're not actually working against hate. This is a song which contains its anger through great beauty of cadence and through a particular technical device, which is that the name of the woman who's killed, Hetty Carroll, and the name of the man who killed her, William Zanzinger, both of their names, first and second names, happen to have an unstressed final syllable. That is, it's Hetty Carroll and it's William Zanzinger. And the end is this dying fall of an unstressed final syllable. Mm. And every line of the body of the song uses that, and the refrain is all what we call masculine endings, that is, stress syllables. Mm-hmm. You who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face, now ain't the time for your tears. So it's a beautiful contrast to the body of the song, which always has this dying fall. William Zanzinger killed poor Hetty Carroll with a cane that he twirled around his diamond ring finger at a Baltimore Hotel Society gathering. And the only moment when it's different is when he kills her. Got killed by a blow, lay slain by a cane that sailed through the air and came down through the room. Not got killed by a blow, lay slain by a truncheon that sailed through the air and came down through the chamber. No, just you cut off her life by lopping off an unstressed final syllable. And it's drama without ever being melodrama.
Christopher Ricks, this is wonderful. We're going to do much more. We're talking tonight with the great literary critic, Christopher Ricks, about the American singer, songwriter, poet, Bob Dylan. Christopher Ricks' new book is Dylan's Vision of Sin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with much more.
With a shrug of his shoulders and swear words and sneering, and his tongue it was snarling, and in a matter of minutes on bail was out walking. And you who philosophize disgrace, and criticize all fear. Take the rag away from your feet. Now ain't the time for your tears.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the great American singer, songwriter, poet, Bob Dylan, with the great British literary critic, Christopher Ricks. His new book is Dylan's Visions of Sin. Behind us, of course, Like a Rolling Stone.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, lose a bunch of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say, beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you.
Let me put it straight to you. In the book, at various points, you compare Bob Dylan to Marlowe, Keats, Tennyson, Hardy, Yeats, Marlon Brando. I mean, leave Brando aside, but you are a scholar who has been in the vineyards of the greatest of English poets, English language poets, all your life, and you're willing to put Bob Dylan right in there. As far as I can tell, you're not drawing a line around him, a boundary, saying he's lesser. Have I got that right? Is he really in the pantheon at that high altitude?
Well, he is for me, and I think he is for a lot of people too. I mean, I know I'm not alone in admiring and delighting in him, and I'm not alone among, as it were, the class of people. That is, I belong to a group of people who either earn a living or delight in talking about works of art. My brother doesn't delight in talking about works of art. He just loves certain poems,
no.
And that's fine, but it's a different cast of mind or a different choice of life. I think Dylan belongs in the company of these writers, and one of the things that's interested me in writing the book is to think of the poems as being in some way in conversation with one another. That is, what I'm interested in repeatedly is not whether a particular song by Dylan had a source in a poem by John Donne, though I love it when Dylan says that he read poetry when he was young in the way in which people now read Stephen King.
Yes.
And that among the poets he read was John Donne. So that's
speaks
fine.
To Christopher Ricks very nicely.
Good. But I think what matters is the way in which you can see something about the greatness of human community by seeing how often a response is like and unlike somebody else's. So that if I take a poem by Hardy and a song by Dylan, it's not to say they're the same. It's to say that they have some of the same concerns and they see and show different truths.
You're saying there's not necessarily a literal resonance. It needn't at all be that Bob Dylan sat around reading Hardy and then went out and wrote X, Y, or Z song, but that simply he's going to be resonating to the cadences, to same, what, original sources, Bible, you name it. What's the link that you draw?
Well, sometimes the link is, for me, very, very specific. And, of course, we have the bit of luck that Dylan himself sings about Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the Captain's Tower. So if people tell me I shouldn't mention T.S. Eliot, I want to say, well, excuse me, Dylan mentions T.S. Eliot.
What song was that?
That's Desolation Row.
That's right.
And
that's
it's
right.
A vision, of course, of modernism as the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the Titanic
going
sails
down
at dawn, Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the Captain's Tower, while Calypso singers laugh at them. Well, Calypso singers shouldn't laugh at T.S. Eliot, though T.S. Eliot perhaps laughed at Calypso singers. That's about highbrow, middlebrow, lowbrow, mm-hmm. snobberies and so on. But, you know, Dylan loves to sing it when he's got in it, talking about a love affair. He says about love affairs, mine have been like Verlaine and Rambo. Now, why do people come along and assume that Bob Dylan knows nothing about these French poets? Why did he put them into his song if he's really kind of hibbing ignoramus?
What 60s hipster in Greenwich Village didn't know about Rambo?
Well, thank you. Yeah, but knowing about the love of Verlaine and Rambo and rhyming Rambo with "You're going to make me lonesome when you go." I mean, the G-O rhymes with B-A-U-D. Come on now.
He's an American. He can take the liberty.
Yeah, well, it's a lovely liberty because it's got a mischievous twinkle in its eye.
Let's hear a little bit of that. Desolation Row.
Praise be to Nero's Neptune. The Titanic sails at dawn. Everybody's shouting, which side are you on? And Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the captain's tower, while calypso singers laugh at them and fishermen hold flowers. Between the windows of the sea, where lovely mermaids flow, and nobody has to think too much about Desolation Row.
And so you go through song after song. When did you begin this great project, Christopher? Did you start out as a casual Bob Dylan listener like millions of others in the mid-60s, early 60s?
Well, I've said this when other people have asked me your perfectly good question. That is, when I was in Berkeley in 1965, I didn't listen. When you say casual listener, I want to say, no, listening isn't casual. There's casual hearing, but you either listen or you casually hear. And I think Dylan is not good as a thing to hear. He's a great thing to listen to. There's certain music which can be somewhere in the background and not make you feel guilty.
But he's not mood music.
Exactly. No use trying to use him with the white wine in the ice bucket.
Hey, baby.
The distinguished lighting.
well, maybe in 1968 music. It worked. But,
well, yeah, I was 35 then. Maybe it was too late for me. Yeah. So I didn't start listening to him until the late 60s. And I think I'd been a bit snobbish about that. And a friend gave me an album. And if people give you things, you listen to them.
Yes.
If somebody lends you a book, you don't necessarily read it. And I was very, very moved by them and delighted by them immediately. It took me ages to write this book, and I kept having a kind of excuse, which was that it is very difficult to write about songs. Surely you've got to hear them. And I suppose I knew that all the time he was producing new wonderful songs, so that there's a sense in which there's an encouragement, don't do it yet, because you haven't got all of him on the shelf. Lord Melbourne said in the 19th century, when somebody died, an artist, he liked it when they died, because then I know I have all the fellows' works
all
on
in.
The shelf.
Right.
Well, I don't want
to go to work
to
on the full body, the corpus.
Exactly. So that it's been a bit of luck for me, that, and for the world, not in terms of my book, but in terms of Dylan's art, that 20 years ago when I signed a contract, there weren't half of these ones songs. She didn't have Got to Serve Somebody, a Handy Dandy, or
no.
A Precious Angel.
It just
baby.
Kept coming. It kept coming in times that were good and rich and productive for Dylan, and times that were not. He's had some difficult, even fallow years. Mm-hmm. Behind your interpretation, do you focus on, do you think about Bob Dylan, the person?
I don't much, really. I think that the, how do I put this, art makes public the most private feelings. Private feelings of the people who create it and of those to whom they speak. There's some very strange combination of the public and the private. I think that artists need to respect their privacy. The great modern artists have done it in two quite different ways. If you're Samuel Beckett, you never, if you can possibly help it, say anything about yourself or your work to anybody. You don't cooperate in any kind of biography, you don't. Mm-hmm. So that's one extreme. Mm-hmm. At the other end, you acknowledge the celebrity culture which we live in by kind of going along with it and being like a cuttlefish who escapes by announcing where he is. The cuttlefish
yes.
tells you where he is
Here
in a cloud of ink.
Then I'm gone.
And
yeah.
I'm gone. And that's been Dylan's. Dylan has given these interviews in which he's been elusive. He's had songs which are not, you know, you can call me this, you can call me that, you can call me Zimmy.
Bob Zimmerman Zimmy.
You can call me that in Got to Serve Somebody. But still, he is elusive. And he's elusive in the way in which Charles Dickens was elusive. Public performance is going with deep privacy. I respect that.
Elusive and yet everywhere. You can barely turn through stacks of albums without him being there. And the music has just become part of America's framing. Let's titch ahead and listen to more 1967 Positively 4th Street. The sin that we touch on here.
Envy. Envy.
Envy.
You got a lot of nerve to say you are my friend. When I was down, you just stood there grinning. You got a lot of nerve to say you got a helping hand to lend.
You just want to be on the side that's winning.
Take us to the sin. Where does the envy come into Positively 4th Street? How?
It comes in because you're the most envious people you know are the people who pretend to be your friends and may even have been your friends. Writing about this, I say, if you want a bad review of your good book, get it reviewed by a friend. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, a friend of mine had reviewed it adversely. So it must be right. So it's about, and it's immediately this wonderfully sardonic, you got a lot of... got a lot of nerve to say you were my friend when I was down and so on. One of the comic aspects of this song, of course, is his putting it on Greatest Hits when he hadn't released it as a song.
Right.
It really went, how could it be instantly...
Friends, you're going to love this.
And I remember having to buy Greatest Hits solely to get Positively 4th Street because I had everything else that was on it.
Right,
There's always this impish, you know, mischievous side to him. It's great.
You quote Thomas Wilson saying, every virtue consists in denying some corrupt inclination of our depraved nature, so that it's in struggling against the sin that a virtue is born.
Yes, I think there are two aspects of this. One is that you've got to contrast a sin with the virtue that it resists, as it were, so that you say courage is a good thing and we mustn't give in to cowardice, as it were. But there's also the way in which a sin stands right next to a virtue. That is, sloth is a bad idea, but certain kinds of relaxedness are a very good idea.
Sure.
Envy is a bad idea, but honourable emulation is a good idea. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a competitiveness in envy that's ugly, but it's not true that all competitiveness is ugly. And that's why I end that part of the book with the sin that is pride, because pride is the only sin which is also a good thing. You can't have a gay envy week. You can have a gay pride week. Well, maybe people are envious.
One day, who knows?
But that right? I mean, but pride has its good side, which is not true of the other sins, though they may be adjacent to them, a good thing. That's not the same as saying there's a good kind of envy. There isn't.
So are you saying that Bob Dylan works that boundary, that he's feeling the tension between the sin and its opposite or its close virtue?
Yeah, I think that he's morally and spiritually and politically very alive. He is very, very sensitive. That includes being sensitive to the fact that there are other virtues than sensitivity. Mm. If you make sensitivity the highest thing in the world, if you're not careful, you'll have a quivering, sensitive plant.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's not a sensitive plant.
But he does come back again and again to sin. I mean, and you draw up some of these lines. People tell me it's a sin. Because he sinned, I got no choice. And there are no sins inside the gates of Eden, that hollow place where martyrs weep and angels play with sin. I guess it's not hard to make the case that this runs deep and entirely through Dylan's work. Does he say so himself? Is he talkative about his work?
Well, I mean, he actually refers, one of the interviews I quote early on talks about the politics of sin. He says, what are the things that people don't listen to or pick up in me? And one of the things they don't pick up in is the politics of sin.
Politics of sin. What a great phrase. What does that mean?
Well, he talks about the way in which politics means you subdivide it. What you do is categorize it in a way which makes you feel better about it. So you're
that
this sin you've identified. So it's as if once you've done the political taxonomy of it, it's as if you've solved it, like people who think that they've paid bills once they've drawn up a list of the ones they've got to pay.
Or a budget, you know, and then just go ahead and go bankrupt or sin.
Yeah, isn't it?
And he touches them all again and again. Lust and Lay, Lady, Lay. You drop right into that category. What a song.
Lay, Lady, Lay. Lay across my big friend's bed. Lay, Lady, Lay. Lay across my big breast, baby. Whatever colors you have in your mind, I show them to you, and you see them shine. Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big breast, baby.
A very fine song, and of course a song that is committed to desire and knows the difference between desire and lust, and knows that it's very difficult to persuade other people that what you're feeling is this honourable thing, desire, as against this not altogether all right thing, lust.
And you hear him saying what about desire and what about lust here?
Well, I think it's a song that wants to differentiate the one from the other, all right. It admits desire, and of course it starts immediately with an injunction. It doesn't say, do you come here often?
Right.
Do I know your sister? Just immediately lay, lady, lay. It's any man's fantasy of how you should open a conversation with a woman. It's very, very beautiful and very languorous. There's a cat-like movement in it of a very fine kind.
And you're saying this is lust being described?
Well, no, I think that what I try to do in this chapter is start with songs that are directly about lust,
yes.
And there are some early songs that do that, and they're raunchy and they're a world in which you get you a woman, and there's a world of brothels that he invokes in some of those early songs. Lay Lady Lay is a desire song. It's not a lust song. But I put it in the category of lust because it's the ability to resist lust. And at this point, my argument gets a bit complex or self-deluding. It's tricky, that bit.
And when you listen to these lyrics and then reach out to your universe of poets, who do you hear?
Well, he's doing something which other poets do. It's not necessary to know the other poets to have fastened upon or delighted in the same thing. You say about this song, why are the two lines in it that don't rhyme when all the other lines do? That is, poets are people who love rhymes, mm-hmm. but they also love what you can do when you stop rhyming for a moment. Why wait any longer for the one you love? Is a line that uniquely doesn't connect with any other line. It connects in it through the syntax because it kind of rhymes in terms of sense with why wait any longer for the world to begin.
Yes.
Begin picks up a sound in clean and seen. Love is a sound completely, it's out at the end of the line, unanswered. It's not a word that's going to answer with love. She's either going to lay across his bed or she's not.
Yeah. We bounce off of lust and we're quickly to covetousness. You turn to Gotta Serve Somebody from Slow Train Coming 1979.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
And Bob Dylan covets what, or says what about this sin?
Well, he warns you that however much you covet, in the end, it's a little bit like you're going to, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, but tomorrow you will die, and you're going to have to serve somebody, even if you're starting out as the person who doesn't apparently have to serve anybody. That is very high in the social class, ambassador. But, of course, an ambassador had better serve his or her country. And then you go from an ambassador into gamble or dance, and I think you're invited to think about the way in which ambassadorships are a kind of gamble, and in which ambassadors have to do a lot of dancing. They do a lot of political dancing. They do quite a lot of social dancing. We know what the world of the embassy is like. And then that moves into the boxer. Does a boxer look like an ambassador? No, but he is an ambassador for his country. And, of course, the dancing is what the boxer has to do, too.
Yeah, you must. You've got to serve somebody. We're talking with literary critic Christopher Ricks about Bob Dylan. His new book is Dylan's Visions of Sin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
But you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're going to have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with literary critic Christopher Ricks about Bob Dylan. His new book is Dylan's Visions of Sin. Here's Bob Dylan's Handy Dandy from Under the Red Sky, 1990. Let's listen.
Handy Dandy, controversy surrounds him. He's been around the world and back again. Something in the moonlight still hounds him. Like sugar and candy. Handy dandy. Every bone in his body was a broken, he would never admit it.
Christopher Ricks. Okay, here's Handy Dandy. You put it in the envy category. But never mind that for a moment. I want to ask you about the singing, man. There's so much attitude in Bob Dylan. He's famous for it. And it's not just poetry read on the page or read out loud. It's got all the... big stage, the band, the lights, the arenas where he performs. So what does all that mean if Bob Dylan is a poet at heart, if the Colonel is a poet and there's all this fanfare around it? Does that have any significance, whether it's just the singing of the words all the way out to the arena setting, and how you as a critic assess him as a poet?
I'm going to resist the figure of speech that you've got in Colonel and then a fanfare all around it, because I think...
Any figure you like.
Yeah. Well, what I'm getting at is that I think it's a mistake always to look for a Colonel or a centre. That is, there's twice as much hydrogen as oxygen in water. It would be kind of daft to think the hydrogen is therefore more important than the oxygen. What you've got is an extraordinary compound. Now, it's a different compound live from what it is in the studio. That is, that Dylan would understand perfectly well what Glenn Gould felt about the difference between performing in concert and performing in the studio. Mm-hmm. I think Dylan lately has spoken as if the studios have in a way let him down. I think that he's not altogether fair to his own extraordinary achievements in the studio. I think that it is wonderful to hear him perform. I delighted in the three recent Boston concerts, three nights running. There
and
I
you
was.
Went to all
the
three.
The Avalon Ballroom, there I was. And I loved it that on each occasion we went out into the night with the last words of his being, none of them along the line know what any of it is worth, and none of them included himself. That is, that no really great artist knows what he has done and its exact worth. That is, that it's an extraordinary gamble. Art is an extraordinary gamble. Whether this will turn out... I mean, Eliot was always saying that he couldn't be confident of the worth of what he had done. I mean, he just, you know, he trusted in God that it had been worth his life, that he gave it to poetry. Dylan has this great faith. I think he's a man of great faith and a great generosity in performance.
But what does it mean that his poetry is surrounded, the compound with, mixed with, however you like it, with performance? Does it make him even more full-bodied poet because there's a physical element to it?
Well, that's tricky for me. That would be a bit like thinking that wouldn't every pencil sketch be an oil painting if it could?
No, because the pencil sketch.
I mean, less is more. I mean, it isn't just modern art that tells you that less is more. To be able to do that much with simply grey and black and white is a very extraordinary accomplishment. Mm. So that I prefer not to set the one against the other. I go to the concerts. I don't travel as rangingly as people who are younger or even more committed than I am.
You're not a deadhead Dylan head travelling the world following the master.
I don't quite do that, and it's not to be grand and so on. I think the concerts are wonderful. I think that Dylan personally needs the intensity of the relationship that he has, of great delight all around, and as I say, of great generosity. It's quite touching that one of the things he says, you'll remember, is that it's when he's on stage that he feels most alive and, as it were, least alone. Those aren't his exact words, but the feeling that it's there that he is most fully himself. That said, the studio performance of Not Dark Yet can catch exact nuances and exact timbres of the voice that you won't get in the drive and pulsation and energy of the concert. Energy is eternal delight, but there are other delights too.
Right.
And the concerts are most remarkable, I think, for hilarity and energy. The concert versions of Not Dark Yet seem to me to miss something which is very wonderfully available in the studio version, as you would expect. Do you remember he's asked about, does he think it's better to be electric or acoustic?
Yes, of
course, he wants to not set the one against the other. He just wants something that's not going to smutch. Don't smutch the one with the, you know, don't fall between two stools.
And I think it's you who said that years from now, people who were alive now and didn't go to Bob Dylan concert when they had a chance will be observed with some incredulity by...
That was said by the generous reviewer of me. But I certainly... I'm pleased that my children... I don't know whether my grandchildren... I've got eight grandchildren. Yes. I don't know whether they yet appreciate their bit of luck being alive at the same time. My children treat with a certain scepticism what they think of as my doting. My dotage and so on. But... and they're not against it.
Yeah. Let's look at not a sin, but what is it? Charity, a heavenly grace. You pin that on Eternal Circle from the Bootleg Series, 1991. Let's listen.
I sung the song slowly as she stood in the shadows. She stepped to the light as my silver string spun. She called with her eyes to the tune as I played. But the song, it was long and I'd only begun.
to a bullet of light her face was reflecting. The fast fading words that rolled from my tongue. With a long distance look, her eyes was on fire. For the song, it was long and there was more to be sung. My eyes danced a circle across her clear outline. With her head tilted sideways, she called me again. As the tune drifted out, she breathed hard through the echo. But the song, it was long and it was far to the end.
Bob Dylan's Eternal Circle, Christopher Ricks, where's the charity here?
Well, it's a love song that has a generalized love for somebody whom it individualizes. It's not a song about a particular woman. It isn't quite a song about a fantasy woman. It's a song about a kind of sacrifice that the singer makes, needing to imagine that there is an individual there whom he is reaching. I put it in this particular chapter, but alongside love that's pure, hopes all things, believes all things, won't pull no strings, picking up St. Paul's words.
Right,
and
the
so
Bible speaking.
So that what you've got, I think, here is a feeling that we are rescued from hatred and ugly feelings by a circle that is a virtuous circle. It's not, I mean, most circles are vicious circles. We repeatedly think hell is what we associate it with circles. Dante's the circles
yes,
of
yes.
hell. The eternal circle here is that when the song finishes, what Dylan sings, you remember, is he picked up his guitar and began the next song. There is a feeling of being condemned to something. I mean, he gives his life for his life's work. I mean, he's not nailed to a cross, though he is very interested in the man or the God who was nailed to the cross. But what you have here is an extraordinary hope and faith as well in his own art, which leads to a kind of love, it seems to me. It is a love song.
As a critic, when you read so deeply and so closely, do you find yourself almost like a psychiatrist looking for an essential impulse in a poet, in this case in Bob Dylan?
Well, I think that I do. I believe something, though, that well that fits with that but is a darker thing to think. I pay a great price for the kind of attention that I give to Dylan. That is, if I go back to my brother is a retired businessman.
Yes.
He is moved by poems only because he is moved by poems. Mm-hmm. His wife dies. He is very moved by a poem that comes to his mind. And there's a kind of purity to that, which I haven't got. I'm, in a sense, a professional.
Because you're dissecting, you're listening so closely, you're listening with the professional's ear.
Yeah, and you pay a price for that.
Yes.
That is, the doctor is both more and less sensitive to pain than other people. The judge is both more and less sensitive to justice. The military man, both more and less sensitive to peace and war. I think one of the troubles with the profession I'm in is that it tends to pretend to the young people whom it teaches that they are nothing but beneficiaries of the close study of works of art. Mm. Now, the close study of works of art is terrifically worth doing, or I wouldn't do it. It's not just that I'm paid to do it. It's really worth doing. But you pay a price for it. You pay a price, which is the price that all professionalism pays. The amateur knows less in certain respects, but knows more in some other respects.
Yes.
There's a kind of innocence that you give up when you do the kind of thing I do, and I feel the loss.
Does this come back around to whether or not there's an essential impulse you identify behind Dylan's work?
Well, I don't know whether I think there is a single impulse. I think that one of the most dangerous things that human beings do is
yes.
look for a single impulse. Mm-hmm. That is the one thing necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Coleridge, writing very beautifully about the imagination, he is right. The imagination is the balance or reconciliation of opposite or discordant qualities. It's a more than usual state of emotion with more than usual order. It's that these things are even more familiar than you would have expected and even more surprising, so that the one thing necessary doesn't for me fit this extraordinary commonwealth by which a whole lot of things that are in antagonism mm. come together for a moment. Something is at once permanent and beautifully ephemeral. Something is wonderful in its sound and very, very harsh in its sense. And so the paradoxical feeling of so many things being brought together, the energy with which in Mr. Tambourine Man he asks somebody else to play a song for for him. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, this is his song, but it's a song about, would somebody please play a song for me sometimes?
Right,
that's what it's about.
Right.
It's sort of comic and touching. I mean, if I were to boast about the thing I'm most pleased with in this book...
Please do.
Would partly be, I'm pleased with the 20 pages on Hattie Carroll. I think that is a perfect song, and I really think I've noticed some things about it and so on. But I'm also pleased with the last sentences of the book, in which I say, talk about a certain loneliness and poignancy in Dylan. He is the one person in the world who has to be at a Dylan concert, and the one person in the world who cannot go to a Dylan concert.
No way, no how.
And it's really extraordinary.
He's the man on stage.
Yeah, that's right. And Jane Austen was never able to read any novels by Jane Austen. And I'm sorry for her for that, because she's given us this great pleasure that she could never quite have herself.
And so you give us a great pleasure as well, Christopher Ricks, in the way you pull him into this high company, thinking of him, Jane Austen and Keats and Tennyson and Hardy and Yeats. But what about, we've just got a little time left, but what about all those, that other gang, the Muddy Waters, the Hank Williams, the Robert Johnson, the Woody Guthrie? They're more or less invisible in your analysis of Bob Dylan's work. How do you account for those ghosts, those influences?
Well, I don't know nearly enough about them. Probably none of them has ever moved me to tears. And it's not, you shouldn't simply have a tearometer and say these works of art are great because they moved you for tears. But it does matter to me. There are poems by William Barnes. There are songs by Dylan that move me to tears. Now ain't the time for your tears. Well, now is the time for your tears, very often in adult. So I don't know about them. I was very pleased that the New York Times reviewer praised Greil Marcus, because I've reviewed Greil Marcus very, very favourably, and I honour him for knowing all these things that I don't know.
With his own book that goes deeply into all those connections.
Yeah, and he's done that, and he knows all that, and I wouldn't want to claim that I'm... It's not only I'm not... I don't know, but nothing is sufficient. Nothing is actually necessary. There's no such thing as necessary and sufficient conditions for appreciating works of art. Mm. But one would like to think one had noticed some things that other people maybe hadn't noticed.
I have to say, I read plenty that fit that description in this book. It's a real gift, and clearly the gift of a lifetime of loving and being moved by this American artist, Christopher Ricks. Thank you for the work, and thank you for those hundreds, thousands of perceptions that you've shared with us here. It's really enriching. Thanks for bringing Bob Dylan back to us in a new way, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for your company. Thank you.
Christopher Ricks, author of the new book, Dylan's Visions of Sin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Your charms have broken many a heart, and mine is surely one. Got a wheel tearing a world apart. Love, see what you've done. Just as sure as we're living, just as sure as you're born. Look up, look up. See your maker, for Gabriel blues his horn. Sugar baby, get on down the line. You ain't got no sense to her. You went years without me. Might as well keep going.